listener. Hi, and welcome back to Broadsheet Around Town. I'm Emma Joyce, features editor, and I'm extremely excited to say today's guest is one of the most gracious podcast hosts in the world right now. The British writer and broadcaster started her podcast after quitting her job as a journalist at The Observer in the UK. This podcast has been running for about 20 seasons, including intimate conversations with the likes of Dan Levy, Gillian Anderson, Paloma Faith, Stanley Tucci, and the very first episode with Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I'm talking, of course, about the hugely successful How to Fail. Host Elizabeth Day has garnered a following for her generous and delightful interviewing style. She makes us feel like we're in the room with them as she shares her own stories of divorce, IVF treatment, and reassessing the way she views success. Day is in Australia for a couple of talks in Sydney and Melbourne, so we've snagged time with her between Q&As to chat about her sixth book, Friendaholic: Confessions of a Friendship Addict, a book that interrogates the difference between being a good friend and being just really good at friendships. Plus, Day will talk about the movie she's obsessed with right now and the famous friends she's made since launching How to Fail. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Emma, thank you so much for having me. I was listening to that introduction, which was so beautiful, by the way, and very generous. I'm thinking, that is such a good subheading for Friendaholic. The difference between being a good friend and being good at friendship. I'm permission to steal that, please.
We'll start with How to Fail, though, because I think that's where our listeners will be most familiar with you. You hit that milestone of 20 seasons, which is incredible. What would you say you've learned about failure, and what even is failure, from having these very different conversations with celebrities over that time?
First of all, I want to say thank you to the Australian audience, because when I started How to Fail in July 2018, which in podcast terms is sort of the ice age when we look back, Australia and New Zealand were some of my biggest audiences and some of my most devoted listeners. And so it feels such a beautiful full circle moment to be able to be here talking to you in person ahead of doing these couple of dates. And I have never taken that for granted. So I just want to say thank you for that, because failure has brought me into contact with all of you. And what I've learned about failure and what failure is really goes to the deepest core of what it is to be human. I think one of the most important things I've learned about failure is that it happens to all of us, that no matter how much we might fear it or how much we seek to avoid it, it is at some point inevitable. And actually, once you realize that, that realization can be quite liberating, because instead of living your life in fear of or trying to avoid something that is ultimately inevitable, perhaps we can look at it differently and look at what we could learn from it. And I think that all failure, if handled appropriately, can be a form of data acquisition. It could be that the only data you have acquired going through something really horrible is that you have the capacity to survive it. And that has taught you something very meaningful about your own strength and resilience. But you can also acquire data in lots of different ways. And the metaphor that I reach for when I talk about this is dating. So I was someone who found herself divorced and single in her mid to late 30s, which, as anyone who's listening to this right now going through something similar will know, it's not a great time to be a woman on the dating apps. I mean, it was the first time I'd used apps, and I went through a whole long process of rejection and then building up hope again and then having the hopes dashed and all of that. And actually, what I realized after a while was that it was a helpful process in terms of acquiring data about two things. One, who I was. I didn't really know. I'd been in a series of long-term monogamous relationships from the age of 19 to the age of 36. So this was a good opportunity for me to get to know myself, almost to sort of date myself. But two, it gave me necessary data about what I was looking for. And therefore, that shifted my mindset. When I approached a date, I wasn't approaching it thinking, this is going to be the love of my life, although that would be a happy byproduct. I was approaching it thinking, okay, what can I learn about myself and about what to do differently or the same next time? And that's something that I want to say to anyone who's listening to this who might feel rejected at the moment, that every rejection or every failure can be seen as a nudge from the universe in a different direction. Mm-hmm. So that process of data acquisition, those unsuccessful dates I was going on, I got to a stage where I was able to say, okay, I've acquired data that you are the wrong person for me. I'm going to eliminate you from my inquiries. And that will bring me one step closer to the person who hopefully is right for me. And in doing that with all failure, it sort of removes the personal sting of it. And so I try to adopt that mindset as much as possible in every area of my life. And there are certain failures that won't be applicable for. There are certain failures that are life-shaping and very challenging to come to terms with and to be at peace with. And that can sometimes be the work of a lifetime. The second part of your question was, what is failure? And the pat definition I've come up with after a few years of doing this is that failure is what happens when life doesn't go according to plan. And then you have to think, what might I do differently next time? But also, where's the plan from? Is this life plan actually something that I want for myself? Or is it something that I've inherited from social conditioning, from the family that I grew up in, from watching too many 1980s rom-coms, which is certainly what I did, wanted to live out my working girl fantasy. And really questioning the plan, I think, can empower us all to find out who we really are. And when you find out who you really are, you start to redefine what success is. So success for me now means something very different from what it did 20 years ago. My success is being able to show up as myself in whatever sphere of life I'm present in, whether I'm talking to you right now on this lovely podcast, whether I am writing a book, whether I'm stroking my cat at home with my husband, or whether I'm recording a podcast of my own, I'm me. And it's taken me a really long time to be able to show up as myself. And I'm very grateful for it.
I think so many listeners are very grateful for it because it doesn't really matter who the guest is. I was listening to the Paloma Faith one really recently. And as just as you've mentioned, questioning what is failure from whose perspective, she questions, well, oversharing.
Yes, I love that bit.
by whose rules of oversharing. So it is about that. It's about like reflecting on what it is that we deem embarrassing or a mistake or a failure. I was also thinking about how you've shared a lot of your personal stories, and often you might also be in the middle of what you might deem later as being a quote unquote failure. Did you have any kind of reservations when you're sharing these stories, or has sharing your life just become something that is part of your work across your books, your journalism, and also in the podcast?
It's a great question. I'm so glad that you listened to the Paloma Faith interview because I really got a lot from that specific exchange where I asked her the question that you've asked me. I've just realized that saying it's a great question is like I'm paying a compliment to myself, which is not what I intended because you put it much better. But I said, do you ever worry about oversharing? She said, oversharing by whose standards? And I think that it's something that often gets laid at the feet of women, that idea that we are just blubbing messes of overshare and that there's a sort of emotional incontinence to it and that that is the opposite of power. And I could not disagree more fervently. I actually think that when we are courageous enough to share something that makes us vulnerable, it's the source of the beginning of true strength. Because when you become vulnerable and when you share something that feels like a personal failure, it ends up having far more universal resonance than you could ever have imagined. Because other people will have felt like this too. Well, they will have been through something similar and they won't have felt able to share it. And then suddenly in the act of sharing, they come out of the woodwork and you forge this extraordinary power and solidarity. And there's a whole other argument here about why women have been discouraged from doing that for many millennia. And I think it's the patriarchy not wanting us to understand that there is so much power that comes from our shared vulnerability and so much solidarity. We could actually like change the world with it. Do I ever worry about oversharing myself? Yes, is the short answer. It's not so much that I worry about the instinct to do it because it comes very naturally to me. Mm-hmm. And it's how I make sense of the world. And it always has been, whether I'm writing about something that I've gone through or talking about it on the podcast, I find it immensely therapeutic and clarifying to put words to an experience that I've been through. It's more my concern is how it's received. and how it can sometimes be received by the people who are close to me, by my loved ones, who aren't innate oversharers. And actually, I'm going to stop using the phrase oversharing, just sharing. But for instance, my husband is a much more private person. And so I sometimes worry if I talk about him, just as I'm doing now, that that in some way is going to feel intrusive for him. It doesn't, by the way, and we've had this discussion, and he's immensely supportive of what I do. But I have had situations in the past where other people have found it intrusive, and then I feel like I've done something wrong. And now the rule that I have for myself, I have two rules actually. One is, it is completely fine for me to share my experience of something I've been through. But when it comes to someone else's perspective or someone else's story, I tend not to talk about it at all. So there are certain topics that are completely ring-fenced from my discussion in public. And I would put into that category, you know, I talk about the fact that I got divorced in my mid-30s, and I can talk about that from my perspective and write about it from my perspective, but I can't imagine what it was like for my ex-husband, and nor do I care to. So I don't ever really talk about that. I don't talk about my stepchildren. So I am the stepmother of three, I was about to say teenage children, but the eldest has just turned 20. And I'm very respectful of the fact that they have their lives and they didn't ask to be part of my public profession. So there are certain things that I ring fence. The second rule that I have for myself, and this is something that I've learned over time, is that sometimes when I'm going through something difficult or traumatic, my automatic instinct is immediately to share in some way. And I've learned that that's not an instinct that I should follow, that actually there is far more power and help for others that can come from reflecting privately. And so now I always leave myself a space where I can do that, where I can think through what I'm going through, when I can talk about it to my therapist or my husband, and I can work out how I feel about it first, and then I'm ready to share. And that for me feels a far more considered position. And that's why only relatively recently have I decided to start talking about the fact that I have had 12 years of trying and failing to have children, and I'm now at peace with the fact that won't happen for me. But I'm only at peace with sharing that because it's taken me a year of work to get to that point.
Yes. Yeah. Is this wisdom in a nutshell? It feels like that's something that it feels like wisdom is a word that can sometimes be antiquated in itself. But this seems like it's wisdom. It sounds like it's something that is learned from experience and refined. Have you had any guests decline to come on?
Oh, yes, loads. Yeah. And actually, very often when they decline, it's a huge compliment because it's generally pretty smart people who have done me the honor of listening to the podcast and who therefore know what it is. And it's very often very smart women in the public eye who know that anything they say will be leapt upon by the tabloid press. And the reason I say it's a compliment is because I think they feel that the interview that I would do, hopefully they would feel comfortable enough that they would share and they would want to. And sometimes it's just a question of timing, and the things that they actually want to say and the failures they really want to discuss, they can't do right now because they know that it would just create all of this publicity that they didn't feel equipped to deal with. Now, I've had people sort of decline and then come back when the time is right. And I completely respect that decision, and I totally get it. But yes, I have had people, and I've also tried to kind of reassure those people that I tried very much to create a safe space, and as you do so beautifully here. And I think that's the wonderful thing about podcasts, is that a lot of celebrities who've been burned by newspaper articles, and I speak as someone who used to be a newspaper journalist, they know that when they come on a podcast, all we have are their words. I'm not capable then of slapping a negative headline on it, of only selectively quoting various things and seamlessly linking with a slightly sort of chippy paragraph that I've written about what I think of them. And I think when people do take the risk of coming on How to Fail, the biggest compliment you can then pay me is to say at the end, that felt like therapy. I felt like I've really got something off my chest. And I think that comes because I do say at the very beginning, you're in control. And if there's anything that you say that you wish you hadn't, we'll just take that again. If there's anything I ask that you don't want me to ask, just tell me, because it's so important. I realize I'm asking them a lot. I'm asking them to be vulnerable, and often with someone they've only just met. And it's really important for me that they feel safe.
Is there anyone you haven't interviewed yet who you are desperate to interview on How to Fail?
Yes. I mean, it sounds like I'm just saying this because she happens to be performing in Sydney on the same night as I am. But Taylor Swift, I mean, talk about failure. I had failed to realise that the one night I'm appearing in the Sydney Opera House, Taylor Swift is also appearing doing her Eras Tour. And I know that we have a sort of cross-cultural
Venn diagram. You have a cross-section
of,
yeah, we do. Our fans.
I think she would be fascinating because she is so clever and thoughtful about what she does and how she does it. And one of the most extraordinary creative powerhouses of our time. And someone who has weathered life in the public eye incredibly well, it seems, from an outside perspective, even though it's been very tricky at times. So I think she'd be fascinating. I also would love the basketball player Michael Jordan. I, like many other people, watched The Last Dance on Netflix during lockdown. And the 90s is very much my era. But he has said some amazing things about failure, about how he misses more than he shoots the hoop. But the reason he trains is for those moments of success. But 99 times out of 100, he will fail to make the shot. And I think he would be fascinating to chat to. And then either of the Obamas, I'm not fussy, either one of them, happy to have. Although I do have a friend, I've got to know Jay Shetty through the podcasting world, and he recently interviewed Michelle Obama. And I sent him a text to say, that was amazing, congratulations. He was like, he had asked if they could come to his studio. And they're like, yeah, we absolutely could, but we'd need 20 separate rooms for security. He was like, okay, I'll come to you. So I think that might be a bit of a logistical challenge.
I would love to move on to Friendaholic, Confessions of a Friendship Addict. You've basically said that friendship is one of the biggest loves of your life. And this is about assessing the quality of friendships and also who you're choosing to spend your time with. What spawned the idea for this book?
We totally nailed what it's about. So thank you for that. And thank you for being called Emma, which is one of my favorite names in the world, because my best friend is called Emma and she is in the book. And actually she had a large part to play in why I wrote it, because when the pandemic happened, our diaries emptied overnight. And I was confronted with two realizations. One was that I missed my truest, closest friends with this startling acuteness. I missed Emma so much, and I missed her physically, which was interesting to me because we live in different cities and we don't necessarily see each other that much, or we hadn't until that point. But we'd always been present for each other, and we'd sort of voice noted and FaceTimed and all that. But I missed her hugs. I missed her smell, like the smell of her perfume. I just missed sitting with her, not necessarily saying anything, but just being in her presence. And the second thing I realized when I looked at my diary was that I had not seen these people enough. I had actually not been spending my time with the people I loved the most in a platonic sense. I had been frittering away my evenings and my social life, trying to meet the needs of people that I'd only just met, work acquaintances, people that I might have run into at yoga class who I had really got on with, and there'd been that moment of immediate instant connection when we first met, but it had somehow translated into a friendship that I hadn't ever fully intentionally committed to. It just sort of ended up like that. I was like, hang on a second, why am I rushing? Why has that happened? And it was that question. I was like, why has that happened? Because friendship is so profoundly important to me. And I felt that I was undermining its very essence by trying to be all things to all people. And that was the starting point. I thought, what do I think of friendship? And why isn't there a book that I can reach for that teaches me about it? And I think it's partly because as a society, we have elevated romantic love above all other forms of love for centuries. All of our greatest sort of music and works of literature are dedicated to that endeavor of explaining what romantic love is. And actually, in the interim, we've taken friendship for granted and we haven't developed a vocabulary that is sufficiently unique and well thought through to express its multifaceted importance to so many of us, both its presence and its absence. So Friendaholic was a personal journey to understand my own feelings about friendship and how I'd got into the situation, but it was also a broader attempt to provide that missing language.
You refer to this idea of having five close friends, which has come from Robin Dunbar's thinking around how many close friendships anyone can maintain in one time. How are you doing in your friendship addiction? Have you been culling? Do you have five?
Well,
how are you thinking about things at the moment?
I am a friendaholic and I always will be. So I now understand that I'm not cured of it, but nor would I want to be, because I love connection. It's what makes me high. That's what gives me that adrenalized buzz. Like, I love being able to connect with people, but I'm much more careful now not to overpromise at the outset, that actually it is completely appropriate to have some boundaries around your own friendships. So, and what I mean by that is, if you overpromise and you underdeliver, then you undermine who you are as a friend, and no one really knows what they're going to get. And actually, in order to be a better friend, not only to your inner circle, but to yourself, you need to start saying no to other people, because otherwise you dilute friendship and what it means to you, because you're trying to be a friend to everyone and with everyone, and it's rendered meaningless. So I have definitely got better at nurturing my inner circle, but it is bigger than five. And I'm so glad you quoted Robin Dunbar, because he is the OG of friendship studies. He's the most incredible person. I've met him since writing Friendaholic, and he's also lovely. And we had this long running joke about how we mustn't be friends with each other because that we've already got enough in place. But yeah, he says exactly what I've just tried to put into words, but he says it better. He says to think of friendship as a series of layers. So it's not about who's better and who's worse, but in your first layer, you have emotional capacity and enough time to have up to five key relationships. So that might be five friends, but if you are married or you're in a long-term romantic relationship or you have children, Dunbar says that will generally cost you two of those other key relationships. And I realized that I'd been doing friendship wrong, because I'd been trying to be that inner circle person to everyone in my life. And it meant that there was no discernment. And actually, that wasn't doing anyone any favors. And then there are other layers that it goes up in increments of five. So then there's a layer of 10 or a layer of 15. And those friends will be incredibly important in myriad ways, but they're not the ones who you will turn to at 4 a.m. in the morning if you're going through a life crisis. They perform different functions as you do for them. And that's completely fine and appropriate and as it should be. And I think the other thing I was doing wrong, which I think is quite common, I was trying to keep hold of friendships for life, because I felt that if a friendship ended, that was a personal failure and I felt very shameful. And actually now I realize that a relationship is not a failure simply because it ends, that sometimes the most loving thing you can do is to evolve a friendship into something different. And it might be that it doesn't have a daily part to play in your life anymore, but that friendship has forever shaped your landscape, your internal and external landscape. And that's a way of paying tribute to it.
In the way that you talk about friendship, you have borrowed some of the language of the way that we talk about romantic relationships. Why have you done that? I'm in my mind, when I'm asking you this question, I'm thinking about a moment that you describe where you feel like you have been ghosted.
Yes.
So was that helpful terminology to help tell people how it felt?
It was helpful terminology. And whilst I was trying to develop an entirely new vocabulary of what friendship was, it was helpful reaching for romantic love phrases, partly because I wanted to make the point that friendship is as important. and that it is a form of love. And so it was a way of co-opting that language to elevate it into a central thinking point where we should all be thinking more seriously about it. Because when we dismantle what it means to us, and both, as I said, the presence of friendship and also the absence of friendship, then we understand what we mean to ourselves. And yes, I was ghosted by someone who at the time I considered one of my three closest friends. And that experience felt like a terrible breakup, but a breakup with no narrative to it. And into that space, I had to put my own narrative and my own explanations of what might have happened. And that was a slow motion grief, the likes of which I've not experienced before or since. And it was a very specific kind of grief that was different from being ghosted romantically, but did have some overlap. So it was just a helpful way, a helpful shorthand, really, to get people into that thinking space.
Is there anyone you've interviewed or really met professionally who has become a really good friend of yours?
Yes, there is. And actually, it's partly because the interviews I do for How to Fail are so intimate sometimes and so vulnerable that
sometimes, most of the time.
Most of the time. And so, I mean, so one person I can mention, Trini Woodall, who has become a dear friend of mine, and she recorded How to Fail remotely. So we hadn't met, we did it over Zoom. And she spoke so beautifully about her own fertility journey. She did 17 rounds of IVF and she has a wonderful daughter, but the pain of that, just of that trying and failing, I can relate to it very deeply. And so we bonded hugely over that. And then we met and she has become someone who is so important to me in myriad different ways and is also just so fun to hang out with and amazing to get style advice from. So Trini's become a friend. And then the other person who is also very important to me is Stanley Tucci and his gorgeous wife, Felicity. We've got to know them as a couple. So they're our kind of couple friends. And that's quite a rare thing where your partner likes the other two people as much as you do. And so we've hung out a bit. So I never take it for granted. I'm an extremely privileged person to get to be able to do that kind of stuff and to get restaurant recommendations from Stanley Tucci.
I was going to say, does he have any recommendations aside from Everywhere in Italy?
I'm actually embarrassed that I haven't asked him about Australia. I'll have to text him after this. We recently went to Paris together and we ate some exquisite food. Let's just put it like that. But oh my goodness, the eating and drinking pace. After about 3 days of it, I was like, I think I've got gout and I now need to just drink green juice for 2 months.
I know that he's also a fan of one of your books, Magpie.
Yes.
And he gave a really interesting review of it where he said it was slightly weird and a little bit creepy as well, which I loved. I loved that. Are you working on any other fiction?
I am. Yeah, I'm actually writing a new novel as we speak. So it's still in the early phase, which I actually really like the early phase of writing a novel because you can kid yourself it's going to be absolutely brilliant because you haven't got to that point where you're 100,000 words in and you're like, oh, this hasn't turned out the way that I wanted it to, but it's just going to have to do. And that's the thing. I mean, writing novels has taught me so much about failure because most novelists will start out with these grandiose plans of building some beautiful cathedral of words. And by the final page, you've built a perfectly serviceable garden shed. And it's great for people who want a garden shed, but it's not the cathedral you imagined in your head. And that's been a really great learning process for me to understand what I'm actually good at rather than what I want to be good at.
Now, this may be related to the way you work, but it doesn't have to be. Are you a morning or nighttime person?
I was going to say neither. Because I love sleep so much. I love bed, okay? Just like Brick in Anchorman loves lamp, I love bed. But if I had to choose, if I've had a good night's sleep, then I do love the mornings. But I tend to work, I tend to write in afternoons, actually. I tend to go to coffee shops and write surrounded by the murmur of other people, which meant that during lockdown when I was writing a novel, that was a kind of interesting experience where I was in our spare room. And in order to recreate the idea of being in a cafe, I got white noise from YouTube. It was coffee shop sounds. It was like a seven hour recording of coffee shop sounds, and that got me through. But yeah, I really like being surrounded by that buzz. So I would say morning, but then if I've had the appropriate amount of spicy margaritas, then nighttime. But I'm always, the lure of bed is always more for me than the lure of a party.
Are there any memories for you from lockdown that are either joyful or just something that you keep harking back to?
Yes, so many. And I think it's one of those things that we're only just beginning to process emotionally. It was so terrifying to begin with. Those days without a vaccine and the virus spreading across the globe, I actually stopped watching the news. I realized quite early on that that was bad for my mental health. One of the most difficult times of lockdown for me and for my husband. I hadn't thought about this for ages because clearly I've been in a state of denial. So our first lockdown was announced at the end of March 2020. And the day after that lockdown was announced, I found out I was pregnant. And as I've briefly mentioned, I had yearned to have a baby and I'd had years and years of fertility issues. And this pregnancy was a bit of a surprise. Like, I'd had various medical interventions the month before, which we hoped might help. But the timing of it was so intense because obviously in the depths of those early days of lockdown, and I was a high-risk pregnancy and I had to be monitored, but that was really difficult to do because there were only so many medical professionals to go around. And I remember going for a scan and having to order a mask. Masks were just coming into the public consciousness. And this very enterprising fashion designer had started making fabric masks. And I remember ordering one from her and her sending it to me so that I could go for the scan. And we had a miscarriage and it was a really, really difficult one. It was the worst I've had. It was my third. And we had gone in for a scan, seen a heartbeat, felt, oh my gosh, now we can start to relax. And then we went in for a scan the following week and the heartbeat wasn't there anymore. And I had a medically induced miscarriage, which meant they gave me tablets. I went back home and I miscarried at home. And it was traumatic and extraordinarily painful on every level, physically and emotionally. And partly because it was happening in this dystopian vacuum of what we were living through. So that was a really, really difficult thing to go through. It pales into insignificance given what so many other people went through with their loved ones, with tragic losses, the frontline workers who we owe such a debt of gratitude to. I can't even imagine what their pandemic was like. Having said that, some of the best memories were spending time with my now husband. So we had just moved in together and we actually ended up getting engaged and married during the pandemic. And my happiest times were actually having dinner with him every night. And I got into this really lovely routine of writing my novel between 5 and 7 in the spare room with my cafe white noise sounds. And then I would come downstairs and Justin, he's an amazing cook, he's half Italian, would have made dinner and I would come down and I'd have a margarita and we would have dinner and we would talk about what I'd written. And it turned out he was the most amazing plot consultant. So that was so special. And it's also something that we have taken out of lockdown and sought to introduce more into our day-to-day life. So we will make more time for ourselves now.
There's so much within what you've just given us.
Sorry.
I feel like I do need to say that, I'm sorry that.
Thank you.
Because it is a loss. And you saying that it pales in comparison is generous of you, but also it shouldn't pale in comparison. It's a loss. And,
Emma,
you have all of those feelings connected with lockdown and that's important. I love that you have connected so much with your husband in that time. And that's become a beautiful moment that's come out of this loss and this tragedy that happened personally, but also on a global scale in a really wild way. It's hard to even reflect on. And I know it only really happened within just the last 3 or 4 years. yeah, it is. It's a lot to unpack. And I hope that your time in Australia means that you get to spend a bit of date night time with your husband. Is there anywhere that you have eaten or had a cocktail in Sydney yet, or has it been too soon?
Well, I arrived yesterday morning and then I was so worried about the jet lag because it seems to be a constant topic of conversation for anyone British. If you fly to Australia, everyone has their take on the thing that you should do to avoid or minimize jet lag. And I felt like I had so much conflicting information. I just wasn't sure what to do. And I was so nervous about it. I was like, I'm going to feel completely incapable. And then I arrived yesterday. It wasn't that bad. Wasn't that bad at all. So I arrived yesterday morning and we went out last night. So I've had one meal, but it was exceptional. It was at Cirrus.
Which is in Barangaroo.
Thank you, because I knew it began with a B, but I didn't know the rest of the word. The most delicious food. It was one of those restaurants. I ordered the prawns, the giant prawns, and it came in this exquisite broth. And it was so good that I had to then order bread in order to mop it up. Absolutely delicious. And I had a spicy margarita there, which had a real kick to it, because often people don't make spicy margarita spicy enough. They absolutely did. My husband had a Negroni and then went into martinis, and my friend Hayley had martinis. I'm so looking forward to exploring the food and drink scene here. And I have a list of recommendations as long as my entire height, which is 5'11". And I am going to Fire Door soon, which I'm really excited
Lennox
about.
Lennox Hastie's.
Yes.
Restaurant in Surrey Hills. And I've just recommended that you should either go to Gilda's or Barkapan in Surrey Hills and then walk to Fire Door. It depends on your
I'm totally up
reservation
for it.
Time, of course. But yeah, there are so many places that you should go to while you're in Sydney and Melbourne. So
oh, yeah. And then
do.
We were chatting before we started recording that in Melbourne, I go to Melbourne tomorrow and I'm having dinner in Gimlet.
At Gimlet, exactly. Which I think is the perfect location for you to enjoy either a Gimlet or a martini.
Both of which I love.
So you will be right at home. Is there anything you're obsessed with at the moment or just can't stop thinking about?
Oh,
I know you're a fan of reality TV, but I don't want to necessarily lead you in that direction if you're obsessed with something else.
So happy to be led in that direction. Before I get onto reality TV, I have finally watched Oppenheimer. So it took a really long time. I went to see Barbie on the day it was released, and obviously famously it was released on the same day as Oppenheimer. And then I just never got around to watching Oppenheimer. Loved Barbie. I'm obsessed with Margot Robbie. That's number one obsession.
We're all obsessed with Margot Robbie.
finally watched Oppenheimer and thought it was such an exquisite piece of filmmaking. The reason I thought it was an exquisite piece of filmmaking is that the acting was extraordinary, but the way that Nolan splices together scenes to give a mood board of character and time without ever undermining the plot is absolute genius. So I'm obsessed with that film. And reality TV is an evergreen obsession. I'm currently obsessed with when Married at First Sight Australia will be aired in the UK. I understand it's happening anytime soon, and I'm trying to avoid spoiler alerts while I'm here. And I love the Real Housewives franchise, including the Real Housewives of Sydney and the Real Housewives of Melbourne. And reality TV sometimes comes in for a lot of criticism, which I think is completely unjustified, because I have discovered so much of what it is to be human from watching reality TV, especially watching interactions between groups of powerful, sometimes slightly unhinged, sometimes slightly camp women. Their interactions are phenomenal, and it's better for my money than anything you see on scripted television. So those are my obsessions.
Is there anything you're really looking forward to doing while you're in Australia?
I'm looking forward to meeting many people who I feel our hands have stretched across various continents and oceans, and we have found each other through the medium of podcasting or through books or through Instagram. And I feel so grateful that I'm going to meet those people either at the Sydney Opera House tonight or at the Art Centre in Melbourne. That's such an extraordinary thing for me to get my head around. The fact that this podcast or these books that I wrote, which it's quite a solitary occupation writing books, and doing a podcast where I felt like a failure in my own life, for that to have spanned across the globe in this way is something I will never take for granted and I'll be forever grateful for. So I'm looking forward to that. Being able to appear in the Sydney Opera House, this iconic building, is just mind-blowing. And I am really looking forward to traveling with my husband because he's come with me. So he has an office out here. He founded and runs a business called Clear Score, which I was telling someone about the other day. And they're like, oh, are they the people who advertise on TV all the time over here? Yes, that's them. And they're also sponsors of Married at First Sight Australia when it airs in the UK. but he's come over. He's working for the week that I'm working. And then we're traveling to the Blue Mountains and Hunter Valley in the second week that we have off. And I'm super looking forward to seeing some of the most stunning landscape that the world, let alone Australia, has to offer, and to tasting some excellent wine in Hunter Valley.
That is a perfect trip.
Oh, I'm so,
so glad,
glad
that you have some time to explore. That's really exciting.
Also, for us. Really want to find a good yoga studio. So I'm going to ask you about that after we stop recording and buy some excellent Australian clothes.
Oh, so many things. Well, I need to get to work on this recommendations list for you. Thank you for spending some valuable time on this podcast. We feel very, very honoured.
I feel so honoured that you've wanted to spend this time with me. Thank you for such a thoughtful, considered and smart interview.
Thank you, Elizabeth Day. That is very, very complimentary. That's all we have time for today, but we'll be back on Thursday with this week's news and recommendations.